Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, it's that time of the year again, and I'm heading off to San Diego this year for the annual International Conference of the Institute for Functional Medicine. I'm sure I'll be bringing back all sorts of interesting tidbits. So we're going to do a deep dive into cancer and all of the new and interesting things we've been learning about it in the last few years, because we're headed into a fascinating toolkit that has emerged. Our new cancer toy box is yielding amazing new approaches to cancer. In our first story, high-speed computers and our ability to study the gene silencing and gene activation states within cancer cells has given us the potential for unprecedented control over cancer. Not just an AI, but very, very high-level analysis called high-throughput analysis has allowed for this advance. The research team in question at the Korean Advanced Institute of Science and Technology has developed a technology to systematically discover the key control factors that can induce reversibility of colon cancer cells through a systems biology approach and using a digital twin simulation analysis of the normal differentiation trajectory of colon cancer cells. To translate, what they've done is they've studied very carefully at a deep analytic level how normal colon cells differentiate from stem cells, and then they have mapped the differences that allow them to turn into cancer cells, and then figured out which of those differences can be blocked. Essentially, they've developed a technology that can treat colon cancer by converting cancer cells into a state resembling normal cancer cells without killing them, thus avoiding side effects. The research team found that during the process of oncogenesis, the creation of cancer, normal cells regress along their differentiation trajectory. Building on this insight, they developed a technology to create a digital twin of the gene network associated with the differentiation trajectory, and they systematically identified master molecular switches that induce normal cell differentiation. When these switches were applied to existing colon cancer cells, the cancer cells reverted to a normal-like state, results confirmed through molecular and cellular experiments, as well as animal studies in mice. This very much reminds me of Dean Ornish's landmark 2014 paper. It's hard to believe it's been 10 years, and his work has still been not broadly adopted by the oncologic community. But then it doesn't involve fancy drugs or fancy technology. It just involves stress reduction, exercise, and a very healthy plant-based diet. Dr. Ornish, way back then, 10 years ago, was able to demonstrate that by using these techniques, low-grade prostate cancer cells could be seen to revert, to re-differentiate into normal cells. And he did this using the analytics of the time, which was much less sophisticated than the current analytics in this story. But nevertheless, cancer cell reversion can be systematically achieved. And this digital cancer cell twin has the possibility of allowing us to do it at a much deeper and more targeted level. It is a highly complex and non-linear process. Cell regulation, genes turned on and off, and the evolution of a cell from a completely pluripotent stem cell to a adult-identified liver cell or colon skin cell. It's extremely complicated, and key is analyzing it at this very high-level computer-sophisticated processing, and in order to pick out the really important master regulators. In this case, I've identified three of them, all of which are known to exist. This was not finding new genes. And we already knew that these were regulator cassette genes, which means they don't produce anything themselves. They produce things that cause other genes to be transcribed. Using this technology, they were able to predict whether a gene is activated or repressed in a given sample and see whether or not they could predict the path using their computer model. It turns out that the simulated trajectory from the initial state towards steady state was exactly or almost exactly what was seen in transcriptome data in cell culture. So they built a sophisticated model that actually mimicked what real cells do. Then they modeled what would happen if they activated those control targets. And what they found was that then they looked at what would happen in their model if they inhibited those control targets. And they found that simultaneous inhibition of MYB, HDAC2, and FOXA2, we will not say those names again, was the most effective pattern. They then did this in mice, and they were able to induce the reversion of colorectal cancer cells into differentiated normal colon cells. This study proves we have the analytic tools to optimize our targeting of cancer fingerprints. And now the task is to find or build the tools to do it outside of a controlled laboratory situation in the real world. Sometimes we may already have the tools in our toolbox, and our next story tells us a little bit about that. This study was done at Memorial Sloan Kettering by Dr. Luis Diaz and Andrea Serkek. They describe it as a complete paradigm shift. The study enrolled 103 patients with solid tumors from gastrointestinal cancers, affecting such organs as the stomach, bladder, and intestines that would normally be treated with surgery. All had tumors with a type of mutation called mismatch repair deficiencies that prevent cells from fixing DNA damages. This type of mutation occurs in 2-3% of all cancers. 80% of patients treated with an immunotherapy drug, dosartlimab, did not require chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery, including organ removal, the trial found. 80%. That included all 49 patients with rectal cancers, who saw their tumors disappear completely after 6 months of treatment with no recurrence at 5 years. 35 of 54 patients with tumors in places such as the colon, bladder, esophagus, and stomach also saw their cancers disappear. This was just announced in the New England Journal of Medicine. You can find the story online. The patients received 500 milligrams of a drug called dosartlimab intravenously every 3 weeks for a total of 9 treatments. Almost 40% had no side effects. Others experienced mild rashes or itching. A rare number experienced infections and inflammation of the brain. So not without its risk, and unfortunately not without its cost. The drug costs about $11,000 a vial, and 9 doses are required. In December, the FDA gave the pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline a breakthrough therapy designation, which accelerates development and review of drugs that could represent a significant step forward. Imagine being in your 20s and having to lose an organ in your body that will change how you interact with the world, change your fertility, change sexual functioning, or just your quality of life in general. People can adapt, but it's definitely a different path. Here's a story. In 2020, a woman named Kelly Spill was initially unsure of her prognosis when she was diagnosed with stage 3 colorectal cancer at 28 years old. As we covered in the most recent weeks, rates of cancer are going up, particularly aggressive colorectal cancer in younger people. Kelly had just given birth to her son 8 months earlier. At the age of 28, Kelly was looking at a very different life trajectory. At best, she would be wearing a colonoscopy bag for the remainder of her life, taking oral radiation and chemotherapy, which would have destroyed her fertility, and perhaps sexual function as well. Hearing that at 28 would be just devastating. So Spill was in the first group that got this chemotherapy. And by her 9th treatment, her cancer had completely disappeared. After her treatment, she was still slated for radiation until she had her radiation doctor check her records. When he called back, he said, "I mean this in the nicest way possible, but I hope to never speak to you again. You do not need any radiation," said Spill. That was the true celebration, because I just knew that had changed my entire life. Today, Spill is pregnant with her 3rd child, and her life is following her original trajectory, thanks to this drug. It's hard to read a story like that and not be happy about all of the aggressive government research money that's been thrown at cancer, going all the way back to the Nixon years. But certainly, in the last 20 years, our development of our gene technology and CRISPR have allowed us not just to study cancer, but to impact it, to change it, to adapt. Here's another study demonstrating a different approach, using CRISPR to build molecules that jam the signals telling cancer genes to wake up and get going. This study comes out of the Peter MacCallum Cancer Center. Scientists there have found a way to use CRISPR to silence gene-causing cancer mutations, which until now have remained off limits to targeted drugs. Dr. Mohamed Farid and his colleagues have shown it's possible to silence some of the big guys, KRAS, G12, NRAS, G12D, and BRAF, BRAF, gene mutations known to drive aggressive pancreatic, colorectal, and lung cancers. They invented a novel method. They selectively degrade RNA messages from these mutant genes while having no effect on related healthy genes. By the way, these genes that I mentioned, KRAS, NRAS, and BRAF, are active during embryologic development when migration and rapid growth and the ability to create new blood cells and ask them to grow towards them are, in fact, exactly what the developing embryo needs. Not so much in an adult animal. CRISPR has been used for 11 years to target and disable or edit specific DNA in cells. Cas13 is a protein involved in this process, which enables the tool to actually target RNA, the downstream information transcribed from DNA. These mutations were successfully silenced. These are single nucleotide variations, small changes in the genetic code that unlock the uncontrolled cellular growth, which is cancers. And these single nucleotide variations have been very hard to target with traditional drugs. So essentially what they do is they create a guide RNA, which is the exact inverse pattern of the RNA in question. Now, DNA, of course, has 2 threads that are connected to each other. RNA has only 1 thread. If you make the opposite thread, it will bind to the RNA, thus prevent the RNA from being translated into an amino acid chain we call a protein. Meanwhile, the normal unmutated version of the RNA is just fine because it doesn't match the CRISPR guide RNA. This is a truly targeted therapy, blocking only the mutated forms of the gene. So this will create greater efficacy and diminished side effects. It can also silence these single nucleotide variants with an unprecedented level of accuracy. More work needs to be done before this can be tested in people, but given what it is, the possibility of off-target edits in the genome is much lower. And that's an extremely important thing because when you sic CRISPR on DNA, it can sometimes find the wrong target. And that can lead to more mutations rather than fewer. So there are other tactics to treat cancer, immunotherapy, or even this really interesting labeling process. Scientists have disguised tumors to look similar to pig organs, thus tricking the immune system into attacking the cancerous cells. This can halt tumors' growth and even eliminate it. Data from monkeys and humans suggest, but scientists say, of course, further testing is needed. This is a novel approach, and it was described in a recent issue of the journal Cell. So we had talked last year about the pig transplants, the pig heart being transplanted from a genetically altered pig, who had been CRISPRed, we like to use that as a verb now, to lack the alpha-galactosidase enzyme. Now, we would love to be able to use pig organs for all sorts of transplants. Pigs are effectively one of our closest relatives, and the livers, the hearts, and the other organs are just about the right size. But human antibodies are highly attracted to sugars that stud the surfaces of pig cells, leading to rapid rejection. Now, that's where the alpha-gal comes in, because that's the big attractor to our immune system. So taking that out of the pigs didn't kill the pigs, but certainly made their organs something that could be transplanted successfully into a human without the xenophobic kind of reaction. Immunologist and surgeon at Guangxi Medical University in Nanning, China, thought maybe they could harness this and direct it against tumors. So they did something called oncolytic virotherapy. Think of the virus as a syringe. What if you infect the tumor with a gene that makes a product that puts an immunological target on its back? Well, that's exactly what they did here. So in this case, the viral syringe is something called Newcastle disease virus, which is fatal to birds, but only causes mild disease or none at all in humans. Applied to tumors on its own, it doesn't really do much, as many of these cancer therapies using viruses have failed to do. Nothing that can really help clinically. But the team engineered the Newcastle disease virus to carry the genetic instructions for an enzyme called alpha-1-3 galactotransferase, the enzyme that makes alpha-gal. This enzyme decorates the cells with that particular pig sugar that provokes such a fierce antibody attack in humans who receive a pig organ transplant. Alpha-gal is basically like the cat hair of organ rejection world. It's very antigenic, and people can even have an alpha-gal allergy. This is caused by the bite of the Lone Star tick, which has bitten some animal that has alpha-gal in its blood, then bitten you, and you develop an intense immune reaction to alpha-gal, leading to gastrointestinal or skin symptoms every time you eat meat. Well, getting back to this Newcastle disease virus vector, they first tested this in monkeys and basically saw an increase in life expectancy of about 50% in monkeys with liver cancer. They then tested it in 23 people who had a variety of treatment-resistant cancers. These would have been people with very advanced cancers. And they included liver, esophagus, rectum, ovaries, lung, breast, skin, and cervix. The results, as you might expect, were mixed. After 2 years, two people's tumors had shrunk, but had not completely disappeared. Five people's tumors had stopped growing, and other participants stopped growing but then began expanding again. Only two participants did not receive any benefit. And I also want to point out that this was a one-time injection with this virus. So as with any new treatment, you don't have the dose right. You don't know how much to use, and you don't know how often to give it. It's quite possible that over a series of multiple injections, you might have gotten a better clinical response. But the fact that there was any clinical response does give us a spark of hope that we might be able to use this technology to fight cancer as well. Here's another curious Trojan horse, clever approach. So a team of researchers at, and I have no idea if I'm pronouncing this correct, Zhejiang University in China, have developed a way to use cryo-shocked tumor cells to fight lung cancer. This study was published in Science Advances in April. They used liquid nitrogen treatment to modify cancer cells to carry gene editing tools to fight tumors in mouse models. As we've already said, CRISPR-mediated genome editing tools hold great promise for treating cancer. However, the problems of tumor targeting and off-target side effects hamper the effectiveness and the safety. In this research, the team found a way to improve targeting of a CRISPR, let's call it a CRISPR toxic, or maybe a CRISPR time bomb. Perhaps that's a better way to put it. They targeted it by converting tumor cells into, well, turncoats and carriers for the tumor fighting CRISPR. The work involved cryo-shocking tumor cells extracted from the patient's tumor, which involved rapid freezing using liquid nitrogen. So this freezing removed their pathogenicity as cancer cells, but preserved their structure and, most importantly, their surface receptor functions. After freezing, the CRISPR-Cas9 system was loaded into the cryo-shock tumor cell, which made its way into the tumor where it was ablated. Essentially, these cancer cells that had been treated with liquid nitrogen honed in on the tumor itself. The team tested their approach by collecting tumor samples from lung cancer mouse models, cryo-shocking the samples, loading them with CRISPR-Cas9 system, and then injecting them back into the mice. The treated tumor cells then made their way to the tumor, where they released the CRISPR-Cas9 system, which included a target that would knock down cyclin-dependent kinase 4. You don't need to know anything about that except to say it's something that moves phosphorus from one place to another, and if you don't have it, you die, which is exactly what the tumor cells did. In comparing the approach to simply injecting the CRISPR-Cas9 system into tumors, the research team found that the newer approach offered greater lethality. The improvement they found was due to greater accuracy in targeting. The deactivated tumor cells were drawn to the tumor. Who knew? Where they bonded with active tumor cells via cell receptors. And then this gave the gene editing system direct access to the cancer cells. It was essentially able to get inside the still active cancer cells and destroy them. So freezing cancer cells using liquid nitrogen actually allowed the cells to retain their antigens. So they might be useful in developing cancer vaccines as well. But cancers, well, they're clever and they're not smart, but the biology is clever. Turns out that cancers build a castle-style moat around themselves to discourage immune cells. Alkaline water and alkaline diet aren't going to fix this one. Cancer cells release a significantly more concentrated level of acid than was previously known, and they form an acid wall that could deter immune cells from attacking tumors. This was from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, and in a new study, which was published in Nature Biomedical Engineering, they capitalized on an accidental discovery. This study revealed a previously unrecognized polarized extracellular acidity that's prevalent around cancer cells. Polarized meaning it's heading in one direction only. For nearly a century, scientists have known that tumors were acidic relative to the body pH. Their pH is below 7, whereas most human tissues are at 7.2 to 7.4. The average pH of malignant human tumors is about 6.8. And here's where you get into the serendipity and the fortuitous discovery. Several years ago, Dr. Gao and his colleagues were looking to create a fluorescent nanoparticle that would label tumors, making sure that we could find them. They found a nanoparticle, pegcetacyanine, which glows at a pH of 5.3. It fluoresces brightly in tumors. But the tumor's pH is only about 6.8 on the average. It turns out that individual cells that were sampled from a variety of mouse and human cancer types were tested using pegcetacyanine. They found that the probes lit up on one side of the cancer cells, but not on the other. In other words, they were polarized. This acidity results from the secretion of lactic acids, which the tumors produce as waste products after digesting glucose or blood sugar. Basically, in tumor tissue, they showed that the cancer cells all lined up, pumping acid away from neighboring cancer cells and into the extracellular environment, forming a zone of higher acidity at the tumor's edge, effectively a wall of acid. Samples from human tumors showed that this acid wall was practically devoid of CD8 T cells within the tumors, an immune cell that's known to fight cancer. When the researchers grew cancer cells and CD8 cells together in petri dishes that had been acidified to a 5.3 pH, the cancer cells were spared, while the CD8 cells were dead within 3 hours, suggesting that this severe acidity might thwart immune cell attack without harming the cancer cells. The previous research from the Gao lab has shown also that lactate, which is the base component of lactic acid, enhances the anti-cancer activity of immune cells. This research is why you will hear about the alkaline diet being a treatment for cancer. I don't know if that's true. That has not been established. But the idea that raising lactate, or better yet, converting lactic acid to lactate might be an adjunct for cancer therapy. Moving right along, a new mRNA cancer vaccine triggers fierce immune response to fighting a terrible malignant brain tumor. In the first ever human clinical trial of 4 adult patients, a messenger RNA cancer vaccine developed at the University of Florida quickly reprogrammed the immune system to attack glioblastoma, the most aggressive and lethal brain tumor. And this is where we have to thank our pets, because the results mirror those that were initially done in 10 pet dog patients suffering from naturally occurring brain tumors whose owners approved of the participation, as they had no other options. It had been done in mouse models of glioblastoma as well. The interesting thing about dogs is that they spontaneously develop glioblastoma. And so we're not dealing with a mutant lab animal that might have different characteristics than a spontaneously developing tumor. It also does make you wonder, given that humans and dogs who live in such close proximity are the only species that develop glioblastoma, you might wonder if it has something to do with our diet. Just a thought. Getting back to the May 1st issue of the journal Cell, and this was last year, the researchers used a special technique to create these vaccines. They were mRNA technology, but lipid nanoparticles, similar to what's been used in the COVID-19 vaccines. But they used the patient's own tumor cells to create a personalized vaccine against that patient's own tumors. And they engineered a complex delivery mechanism. Now, if you think about what the immune system ordinarily sees, it doesn't see a single particle of a virus, right? It sees a flush of viruses as a cell ruptures. And so you have a lot of viral particles present at the same time. Same thing for bacteria. We're generally seeing clumps of bacteria breaking off into the bloodstream. So the researchers decided that they would try to create a cluster of particles that were wrapped around, they call it the bag of onions concept. They found that by encasing that in a lipid nanoparticle, they got a much more profound immunization reaction from the immune system than single particles had. So this method, delivered intravenously, spurred a vigorous immune system response to reject the tumor. The messenger RNA vaccine began working on the tumors very quickly. They went from being cold, in other words, very few immune cells and a silenced immune response, to very active immune response in 48 hours. Glioblastoma is one of the more difficult cancers to treat, with a median survival of about 15 months. Currently, we do surgery, radiation, and some kind of chemotherapy. But as I said, this first trial was done at the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, and these were patients, dog patients, who had developed spontaneous brain tumors. They were terminal. The owners consented to treatment, and the animals did well enough that they then used this in humans. Genetic material, RNA specifically, was extracted from each patient's surgically removed tumor, and then the messenger RNA was amplified and wrapped in this new technical packaging to make the tumor cells look like a dangerous clump of something infectious, reinjected into the bloodstream, and got an immediate and very rapid immune response. The pet dogs lived about 139 days compared to a median survival of 30 to 60 days typical for dogs with the condition. The humans, it's hard to say, this was not a placebo-controlled study, but they either lived disease-free longer than would have been expected or survived longer than expected. So it is a success. They'll now be working on an expanded phase one clinical trial. That'll be 24 adult and pediatric patients, and they'll be looking for what is the optimal and safe dose. Then the plan is 25 children will participate in phase two. And because this is going to involve finding children all over the country, the lab has created a multi-institutional consortium where the Pediatric Neuro-Oncology Consortium, cancer, children's cancer hospitals all over the country, will send the tumor to them, where the University of Florida will manufacture a personalized vaccine and send it back to the patient's medical team. This reminds me of the CAR T cell therapy that's currently being done, where T cells are programmed outside of the body, but cells that belong to the patient in question, and then infused back in. And these are the type of T cells that fight cancer, and they have now been programmed to fight something that is only on the person's own cancer. This particular therapy only works for certain cancers, but it's amazing what we've got and what we're continuing to develop. And it turns out that cancers actually have all sorts of tricks up their sleeve. A group of scientists at VCU Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center has revealed a new genetic code that acts kind of like a mafioso capo recruiting and deploying a gang of tumor cells to incite a biological turf war by invading healthy organs and overpowering the normal cells. The study came out in last year's Nature Biotechnology in December. The researchers also developed an intravenous therapy that empowers healthy cells to mount an immune response and build resistance against these invading tumor cells. This treatment's already been proven effective in ovarian tumors, but it could be used in all cancer types. Quoting study author Isha Madan, We identified a biological mechanism through which cancer cells gaslight the human body, altering the genome of the host cells and forcing them into a state of low fitness. Essentially, epigenetic manipulation of the healthy cells. So let's say that you have a small liver cancer. It develops the ability to gang up on the healthy cells. Previous researchers at the Madden Group had found that the human body has an inherent neighborhood watchdog function, where healthy cells detect abnormal cells and alert other normal cells to effectively prevent invasive cells from doing any damage. The mechanism of this is not well elucidated, but it involves something called the flower code. Every cell in the human body carries a code on its surface. This unknown protein called the flower gene is responsible for delivering a fitness code that can be expressed in two forms, flower win and flower lose. Like the names imply, cells expressing the flower win code are more dominant and overpower and replace cells expressing the flower lose code. Essentially, when they encounter each other, a winner cell will kill a loser cell and occupy its space in an organ. Cancer cells were found to express very high levels of the flower win code, where normal cells more often express the flower lose code. I also imagine this might have something to do with how the body knows when to replace senescent cells. But that's me speculating. Think of it something like checkers, or maybe the more sophisticated game of Go, where the tumor cells surround and overwhelm the flower lose code bearing cells and essentially kick it off the block and replace it. By overpowering the flower win code, they essentially intimidate the host cells and communicate to the neighborhood that they should be allowed to survive and thrive. The researchers have patented a monoclonal antibody that's administered by infusion that specifically targets and binds the flower gene. The drug works by masking the expression of the flower lose code among healthy cells, allowing for the body to effectively continue its regular biological neighborhood watchdog routine and turn away the invading tumor cells as simply, nope, we're fit enough. We don't need any more recruits. Go away. You can't have our turf. Now, the monoclonal antibody has already shown promise in ovarian cancer, but there's strong reason to believe that this is more of a universal and that there may be possibilities for many other types of cancer. So just to tie everything all up into a neat bow, I'm going to read to you an editorial from Nature, 31st of January, 2024. The title, Forget Lung, Breast, or Prostate Cancer. Why tumor naming needs to change. The conventional way of classifying metastatic cancers according to their organ of origin is denying people access to drugs that could help them. Well, my thought is that classification systems are all artificial and all are going to be wrong some of the time, whether we're talking about classifying a plant in botany, classifying a tax deduction, or classifying a cancer. Over the past century, the two main approaches to treating people with cancer, surgery and radiation, have focused on where in the body the tumor is. This has led to medical oncologists, healthcare providers, regulatory agencies, insurance companies, and drug firms categorizing cancers according to the organ in which the tumor originated. But there's a growing disconnect between classifying cancers in this way and developments in precision oncology, some of which we've been talking about through the rest of this program. These use molecular profiling of tumor and immune cells to guide therapy. More than 10 years ago, just to give an example, investigators in the U.S. showed in a clinical trial that the drug nivolumab could improve outcomes for certain individuals with cancer. In the trial, which included people with different types of cancer as conventionally defined, from melanoma to kidney cancer, nivolumab shrank some people's tumors by more than 30%, but had little or no effect on the tumors of others. Now, as it happens, nivolumab targets PD-1. This is a receptor of a protein called PD-L1, which helps cancer cells escape attack from the immune system. Of the 236 trial participants whose tumors could be assessed, 49 responded positively to the treatment. The key determinant was whether their tumor cells were expressing high levels of PD-1. Now, all cancers are different, even if they come from the same organ. They have a different set of mutations, and as they get bigger, they get even more different from another cancer in the same organ. So the logical step would have been to conduct clinical trials that tested the effects of nivolumab and other PD-1 inhibitors in people with metastatic tumors that strongly express PD-1, regardless of the organ in which their cancer originated. But because of the ways cancers are classified as breast, kidney, lung, and so on, researchers had to conduct clinical trials sequentially for each disease type. So for about a decade, millions of people with tumors expressing high levels of PD-L1 were not able to access relevant drugs because trials had not yet been conducted for their type of cancer, so the drug was not approved for their type of cancer, and how convenient for the insurance companies that was. In fact, those with certain breast or gynecological cancers expressing PD-L1 had to wait 7 to 10 years to access PD-1 inhibitors. Now, this isn't an isolated situation. The similar story has happened in clinical trials over the past decade. They include the PPARP inhibitors, which kill tumor cells carrying mutations in the breast cancer genes BRCA1 and BRCA2. These mutations are now known to occur in multiple tumor types, not just in breast cancers, but those drugs would not be available to people whose cancers had not been validated. So we'll talk about 2005, which shows that these inhibitors work in BRCA1 and 2 mutations. Clinical trials begin in 2009 for ovarian cancer. It's approved in 2014 for ovarian cancer, but not for breast cancer. In 2018, it's approved for breast cancer. Meanwhile, 100,000 patients with breast cancer who might have been treated with this drug and benefited died. In 2020, it was approved for prostate cancer. In 2019, pancreatic cancer. But between 2014 and 2020, about 200,000 patients with prostate or pancreatic cancer who might have benefited died. In France and some other European countries, patients are not reimbursed if they take drugs that have been tested in trials in which cancers are not defined by the organ in which they originated. Most of the scientific organizations in oncology organize their meetings and issue their guidelines according to the organ of origin strategy. Over the past decade, cancer centers and universities have transformed oncology into something new, multiple organ-specific subspecialties based on genetic variation in the individual's tumor. The last two decades of cancer research have shown that cancers need to be characterized at their cellular and molecular level. Mutations in the tumor suppressor gene TP53 are a feature of most types of cancers, as defined by the organ in which the cancer originated. What's more, most cancer types can be subdivided into different molecular subgroups. Some lung cancers have mutations in the epidermal growth factor gene. Some have mutations in MET, others have translocations in ALK, and so on. Why lump them together? I think the key point here is that our current classification system actively excludes people who are eligible from a drug at the molecular level, but whose organ of origin has not yet been approved for this drug. This goes across the spectrum. Antibody drug conjugates, antibodies that target membrane proteins, like some of what we've talked about today, they are not able to access these antibodies unless they have a cancer in which the antibody has been tested, even though the antibody is not against the liver, it's against a particular gene which is present in many different cancers. In the experience of most clinicians, any two people diagnosed with the same cancer type, that is to say, liver cancer, breast cancer, can get different treatments, or they may get the same and an inappropriate treatment. It wasn't until 2017 that the FDA first approved the use of a drug called pembrolizumab to treat people who have tumor cells with a deficiency of their DNA mismatch repair system. In 2020, the agency determined that this could be used to treat people whose tumor cells have high numbers of mutations relative to healthy cells and other cancer cells, regardless of the location of origin. That's great, but we need a bigger mind shift across regulators and insurers for many of the drugs that have already been developed that are lying on the table when there's a person in bed who could use and maybe be cured by the therapy. So how will we do this, practically speaking? We will have to focus on analyzing the patient's molecular profiles, regardless of cancer type. Now, this is done frequently with staining when we're talking about biopsies. If you get a skin biopsy or an organ biopsy, we will use certain stains that will identify a particular chemical compound, something genetic, possibly the amount of active cell division that's going on. And that's how we make the sophisticated, what subtype of cancer are we looking at? But this is a visual chemical test that tells us this is a melanoma. This is a fill in the blank. We have to start doing molecular testing across the board. And this is recent. In 2020, societies have recommended that all patients with advanced lung cancer undergo multi-gene testing. And that's great. But between 2010 and 2018, only 22% of people had molecular test results. And that's in the United States and elsewhere. The cost currently costs about $3,000 per test in the U.S., In Europe, it costs $1,000. Nowadays, complete genome sequencing costs about $300 compared to $1,000 a few years ago. And some cancer centers are developing ways to perform molecular analyses themselves, so they won't even have to rely on diagnostic companies. And also, in coming years, artificial intelligence could speed up this process enormously and bring us to the point where we've actually got true personalized oncology. So I bring our last and closing story, beginning with the question, when is racial discrimination a form of restorative justice? I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Duffy null phenotype, which is an under-recognized and widespread source of medical discrimination against people of African and Arabic ancestry. This is a erythrocyte phenotype. It's seen in approximately 67% of people who identify as African American. And surprise, surprise, it confers partial resistance to the malaria-causing parasite, Plasmodium vivax, because it keeps the malaria from getting into the red blood cells. The Duffy null phenotype is also associated with a lower white count, the absolute neutrophil count. It's about 40% lower than people without this phenotype, but it does not confer increased risks of infection or disease. So although this variant is common and its effect on the ANC, absolute neutrophil count, is predictable, cancer research and care practices continue to discriminate against people with Duffy null associated neutrophil count. Areas of discrimination are critical. They include eligibility for clinical trials, adverse event grading, and dose modification for systemic anti-cancer therapies, and remission criteria. So think about it this way. If the absolute neutrophils are always low, and you are doing your chemotherapy to the point where the neutrophils stay above a certain marker, and that is the standard of care. When the patient drops below that marker, or if they start out below that marker, you're going to be reluctant to give them standard therapy. You may reduce the dose, you may reduce the frequency of administration, but you won't be benefiting the patient. Instead, you'll be needlessly increasing the rate of failure of the cancer therapy. 77% of the phase 3 clinical trials for the five most prevalent cancers in the United States and the United Kingdom have eligibility criteria that explicitly or implicitly will exclude some people with the Duffy null phenotype. Here's how it goes. The average neutrophil count range for people with the Duffy phenotype is approximately 1,200 to 5,400 cells per microliter. And about 10% of people with this phenotype will have a ANC of less than 1,500. Clinical trials in oncology frequently exclude patients with an ANC of less than 1,500 or an quote-unquote abnormal blood count on the basis of reference ranges that rely largely on populations of European ancestry. These are used not only in trials of cytotoxic chemotherapy, in which neutropenia-related, neutropenia being low neutrophil count, are expected, but also in 50% of hormone therapy trials in which they are not expected. You don't have to be rigid about this. In fact, we aren't rigid. Trials frequently allow exceptions to bilirubin-based exclusion criteria for patients with Gilbert syndrome, a condition that's associated with a harmless elevated level of bilirubin that occurs predominantly in white people. It affects a percentage of the U.S. population that's similar to that affected by the Duffy null phenotype. Now, we could do it in several ways. Duffy testing is a routine and low-cost component of blood banking. If you've ever given blood, you've been Duffy tested. Well, they may not have told you, but you were, because you don't want to mix blood. The Duffy null people will have a transfusion reaction, not lethal one, but a reaction if they are given Duffy positive blood. So having that information in the electronic medical record, or at least doing it before you embark upon chemotherapy or stop chemotherapy, would be an excellent idea. And it would be a case of discrimination that reduces the inequality. It pains me to think that people's chemotherapy is being reduced, that they're being subjected to dose delays. And I wonder exactly how much of the difference in survival rates from cancer between African Americans and the white population is not due to this difference in the way that therapy is performed, based on fear of driving the white blood count below a point which was perfectly normal for that individual. Maintaining a relative dose intensity greater than 85% during cancer treatment is strongly associated with survival, because it prevents the cancers from being able to develop resistance. It prevents the cancers from evolving. So essentially, anyone with the Duffy phenotype has the opportunity to be undertreated for their cancers. We need new standards for remission criteria for myeloid and lymphoblastic leukemias, myelodysplastic syndromes, and CLL that include reaching the ANC thresholds and don't pay attention, and do pay attention to Duffy status, because otherwise the threshold is being set in the wrong place. In short, the remission criteria for CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, should be adjusted for people with Duffy to a value in the lower threshold of the reference range for people with the Duffy null phenotype. Otherwise, you're not fully treating their cancer, because their normal level is lower than other people. So you're calling it a remission when in fact the person still has active disease. It's not just African Americans, it's also people in the Arabian Peninsula. And so we can't do this as an ethnic group. We just need to test the blood, recognizing that everyone is a little bit different. And when those differences are critical to making the right therapeutic decisions, we need to figure out what they are and take them into account. Well, I certainly hope you've enjoyed this deep dive into modern cancer therapy. I hope you've learned a little bit about immunology, and maybe I've even helped you make a decision or help a loved one make a decision. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.